Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Girl, real talk. This whole it's new year, time to reinvent myself trash is not the vibe for 2024. You can find someone who loves you for you, as you are. You don't need to read a stack of self-help books, only eat sad salads, or like start meditating at 5 a.m. to be ready for dating. So yeah, my advice is to download Bumble and find someone who embraces you the way you are right now. Let me know how it goes.
When you take on a story that begins with some skepticism, like, why should I read this? I don't live in Cuba, and I've never seen an ox in my life, and I don't really care about farming. That's a risky undertaking.
I'm Jordan Kissner, author of the essay collection Thin Places, and this is Thresholds, a weekly series of conversations with writers and artists about moments of epiphany or transformation that changed their lives and their work. A moment that they stepped across, like a threshold, into something new, and the way that experience changed everything they wrote afterward. You probably know Susan Orlean as a longtime staff writer for The New Yorker. She's also the author of a ton of books. She wrote the book The Orchid Thief, which was turned into the movie adaptation. She's written the library book Animalish, a book about Rin Tin Tin, The Bullfighter Checks Her Makeup, which is a collection of her New Yorker profiles, and my personal favorite, a cookbook written by her dog, as told to Susan. Her new book is On Animals, which collects a bunch of essays of hers from over the years about what turns out to be maybe her favorite subject. She writes about owning chickens, about two oxen who live in Cuba. She writes a profile of the whale who played Willy in Free Willy and the various attempts to, you know, set him free after the movie was over. And there's also an absolutely hysterical profile of a prize show dog named Biff Truesdale. The thing about Susan's writing that I really admire is that it all sounds like her. She has one of those personalities on the page that you can kind of spot right away. It's a great example of what young writers seem to be looking for when they talk about wanting to find their voice. So it felt fitting that she came on the show to talk about the assignment many years ago when she realized that she could put herself, her experiences, and her voice into her writing, that she could and should try to write as Susan and not to match some abstract notion of what a writer should sound like. Here's Susan Orlean.
Years ago, when I was writing a story for The New Yorker, about a supermarket, I became very interested in the kind of day-to-day life of a supermarket, a neighborhood supermarket, and what it might reveal to us about the neighborhood, about people's habits. It just fascinated me. When I sat down with all my notes after spending about 6 weeks in the supermarket, I became kind of frozen and I thought, how am I going to tell this story? It seemed like it was a million disparate scenes and pieces and bits of information that didn't have any coherent through line. And I just sat there thinking, what have I done? Why am I doing this story? It has no order or purpose. I don't know what I'm doing. And I thought for a while, it felt like eons. It may have just been a shorter amount of time. And it suddenly occurred to me that if I told the story with including myself as an observer, that I could link all of these pieces together, that acknowledging my presence in this reporting actually provided this perfect rational organization for the story. And it was a revelation. It was something that changed that story and frankly changed all my work going forward. But it wasn't merely like figuring out a technique for writing as much as it was a kind of moment of thinking that transparency and authenticity is always the answer, that writing this piece, being kind of transparent about the fact that I was the observer, liberated me completely, answered the question completely. And while it sounds simple, I think it's something as a writer I had to earn my way to that revelation. And then from that point forward, it seemed to me like, well, that's really the answer in almost every situation that feels stuck and confusing, that the breakthrough is the moment when you peel aside some of the expectations you have, some of the pre-existing ideas that you've got about what something should be, and you just do the authentic thing. I feel like it was really kind of transforming for me to have that revelation, and it certainly changed my work, that's for sure.
What do you think had been the obstacle to that previously, you know, before the grocery store piece? What had been kind of in the way of you realizing that, do you think?
I think that we all do what we do with an unexpressed hidden voice telling us what that thing ought to be, that the way to do something correctly, and certainly this is very true with writing, that there's a way you're supposed to write, and that you do your reporting and you sit down to write and you think of what writing ought to be and ought to sound like. So you have this inner voice full of expectation that you're responding to. It's not that easy to say, well, that inner voice may be well and good, but actually that doesn't help me to simply think, what is it that I feel is expected of this process, but rather what was this process actually all about? Well, it was really all about me observing this grocery store and talking to people and interacting with people. I mean, this sounds so simple, doesn't it? I mean, it seems so obvious, but when you have in your mind a template of how writing is supposed to be, that's a very powerful thing. And it's not that easy to say, I'm going to put that aside and just really write the story that I saw. That's not, it's both the most natural thing in the world, and also it's not that easy to do when you've got decades of being told or having the expectation of what a piece of writing is supposed to sound like. There was a stance that I felt was the quote correct stance of a somewhat more distant observational voice that had the formality of traditional journalism. Well, I don't do traditional journalism, and writing a story about a grocery store is not a particularly traditional story. It was really grew out of my interest in observing this and bringing my own perceptions to it. So it really involved kind of shrugging off a kind of outer layer of expectation of what this is the proper way to do this, and embracing instead what felt like the real experience that I had.
Were you happy with how the grocery store piece came out?
I was thrilled. It was such it really was a breakthrough for me where so much of it didn't show on the page. So much of it really was in my own mind, a sense of confidence about how to write that I hadn't fully embraced at that point. And so would a reader have read it and thought, wow, she's really doing something different here? I'm not sure. But for me, it felt dramatic. It felt like I was onto something new. And so it was really exhilarating.
Was it that you had this sense of yourself that already, of course, you were familiar with because you are yourself, and you just felt permission to put that on the page? Or did you feel like there was almost a newer evolving persona of Susan arriving in the work?
A little bit of both. I think that I had a fairly good self-knowledge at that point, but this expanded my sense of confidence that I could rely on my instincts in a way that I never had before. But also, I thought, the bottom line is I'm a curious person, and I like learning about things that catch my attention, and that is who I am. I'm not an expert in anything. I'm not interested really in mastering one particular subject. I'm much more interested in following curiosity and then bringing readers with me in exploring those curiosities. And each thing I'm curious about, to me, resonates with more meaning. They're not just random odd bits and pieces. They're things that I think have greater meaning. But the justification suddenly made more sense to me. I thought, I'm a person with a very active sense of curiosity. That's why I'm a writer. And I can lean into that thoroughly and say, that's what I bring to it. That's who I am. And I should sort of enjoy that, and rather than try to come up with another rationale for what I'm doing. So I think it did bring some self-knowledge as well as simply confirming to me that I had kind of mental permission to really be who I am in the course of writing.
That's such an interesting distinction you're making between somebody who is a writer and is there because they're a writer and they're curious versus somebody who's there as an expert in something. I feel like very often writers are asked, what do you write about? Or what's your beat? Or what's your expertise? Or what kind of thing do you do? Which can be a very tough question for generalists or for people who write kind of based on where their curiosity is taking them at any given time. Have you felt over the, you know, over your career pressure to be bringing expertise other than the kinds of expertise that you bring as a you know, seasoned and gifted magazine, right? You know, writer and essayist and reporter?
Absolutely. I used to think, feeling sorry for myself, I think, you know, I'm never going to get hired for a job because there is no job that I am clearly qualified for. I mean, if somebody is looking for someone to cover the restaurant world or politics or crime, you know, I've done a little bit of all of these, but nobody would think, oh, let's reach out and see if we can hire Susan to be our new, you know, crime writer. I mean, it was something where I thought to myself, no, there is no job that I am qualified for in that traditional sense. So no editor ever pressured me. I mean, my very first writing job, my editor insisted that we all cover a beat before we just go off and follow our own interests. And I thought, oh, I don't want to cover a beat. But he just felt that it was a good exercise for anybody to really narrow their focus and try to dig in and get to know one subject very well. So I felt like, all right, well, if those are the rules here, I guess I'll give in. And the beat he assigned me to was county government. And it was like, what could be more deadly than county government? This was, you know, admittedly a long time ago. And my editor's interests were very much in sort of the political direction. But county government is, it's almost like you couldn't come up with a duller topic. And I began writing stories that the only connection it had to the county government was that it had taken place in the county. And my editor finally gave up on me and said, all right, never mind. Just do the stories you want to do. I can't make you cover this beat. It's just not going to work. But no other editor ever really pressed me specifically and said, you know, you need to know your stuff and you need to know one topic really well, because I so immediately established myself as somebody who ranged far and wide. And even when I had jobs that nominally were about a particular topic, like I had a column for a couple of years in the Boston Phoenix that was supposedly an arts column, my feeling was that anything is arts. You know, that didn't feel like a limitation to me. So some of the columns I wrote were actually about arts, and a lot of them were just about whatever I happened to find interesting. And in my mind, they all fit in the same rubric as being kind of in the world of arts. Someone else might have said that's insane. These are not in any way on the subject of arts, but I felt comfortable doing that. And nobody ever came to me and said, Susan, you have to be writing more about arts. I think I've had a lot of experiences with editors who've just sort of thrown up their hands and said, all right, just do what you want and just make it good. But we give up on trying to keep you within these boundaries.
How do you feel like you make up for, or do you make up for, the fact that you're often then coming kind of new to a situation? One of the things that you, I don't know, one of the boons maybe of having a subject area expertise is that you're not starting from scratch in terms of your knowledge every time. And one of the, I don't know, to me, one of the great pleasures of starting from scratch is that you're getting to learn a bunch of things you want to know about. But do you feel compelled to do tons and tons of research? So you're coming in as if you might, you know, have known about this for a little longer than you do? Or do you like to come in really, really fresh?
I have two kind of responses. Number one, I love coming in fresh, although in the beginning, it often means that I have to swallow my pride and ask a lot of dumb and obvious questions of people who are very expert, you know, who might be shocked by how little I know. But to me, that's part of the story, which is learning the subject. It means that every story is much more demanding because I'm writing a story about orcas. I don't know anything about orcas. I have to do a lot of quick research so that at least I'm conversant in the subject. But to me, the great advantage is then for the readers, I am their perfect proxy. I am learning the subject the way my readers will learn the subject through me, and that we are kind of going through it together. One of the problems when you become very expert in something is it's very hard to connect with readers who come to the subject unfamiliar with it. So you're either writing way above them and presuming knowledge that they don't have, or it can become very didactic and preachy and with a tone of some sort of condescension, because you know so much and you feel like your readers know so little. Going into a story as I do, really new, makes me kind of inhabit the same space as the reader does, which is, what is this story about? First of all, give me some background. Help me learn enough that I can understand what you're talking about, but also show me how the subject revealed itself. It's easier to do that if the writer is going through that along with the reader. I think that's why some readers follow me into subjects that they don't think they have any existing interest in. And I've had so many people say that to me about different things I've written, where they've said, boy, I never thought I'd be interested in reading about orchids. Or I had somebody say to me yesterday, oh, I heard you were doing a book about libraries, and I thought, oh, how boring. And I thought, yeah, me too. I mean, when I began it, I thought, oh, this could be pretty boring. And instead, it turned out to be genuinely gripping. So I feel like readers, in some instances, have come to trust me because they know that I'm saying, hey, I didn't know if this would be interesting either, but wow, it turned out to be really interesting.
How do you think about whether a story is going to hold your curiosity and a reader's curiosity all the way through? Because I imagine that some of these start like good ideas and then maybe you wind up abandoning them. So how do you tell the difference between one that's really gonna worth sticking with and one that maybe not so much?
That's a great question. And it is a critical fact, because if you enter a story that doesn't adhere to the usual kind of format of what makes a good story, it it's a big gamble. You know, it's a lot safer to do a celebrity profile than to write a story about a couple of oxen in Cuba. You have a built-in audience. There are people want to read about celebrities, for better or worse. And also, people innately feel like, okay, this is a story about a celebrity because celebrities are interesting, whether they are or not. We just have a kind of universal idea that famous people, rich people, beautiful people are worth writing about. When you take on a story that begins with some skepticism, like, why should I read this? I don't live in Cuba and I've never seen an ox in my life and I don't really care about farming. That's a risky undertaking. I generally have 1,000 misgivings about every single story I've ever done, where I first hear the idea and I am really excited and think, oh my God, this is the best idea that anyone has ever had, ever. And this is urgent. This, I have to do it. This is fantastic. Inevitably, then there's a second wave of emotion where I think, what is this even about? No one's going to care. Is this really a good idea? Maybe this is a terrible idea. And there are plenty of times where I don't get past that misgiving and I lose my nerve. I lose the conviction that it's a good idea. And the minute you lose that conviction, it's really hard to go forward because these stories rely 100% on my enthusiasm for the subject. They simply can't go forward without me saying, oh my God, I want to learn about this. So if at any point I lose my nerve and think, it's too obscure, too marginal, whatever reason might pop up in my head, I can't continue. Now, I don't discard a million ideas, but they do have to pass through that circle of fire before I'm really committed. And, you know, many times I will even go to my editor and say, I don't know, I'm beginning to doubt. And I've sometimes had my editors say, no, I think it's, you know, and they've sort of pulled me back from the brink and said, no, you were so excited about it. You seemed so interested in it. And I think, oh, well, yeah. I guess I was interested in it. And you know, I get over some of it is performance anxiety, some of it is genuine, and I think healthy skepticism. Is this gonna work as a story? Is there enough here? Am I genuinely interested enough to make this work and to carry readers along with me? Knowing, as I do almost every time, that the story is going to depend an awful lot on my execution of the story. You don't go into a story about oxen in Cuba with a built-in audience. It's just, you know, maybe a few people who have oxen, but it's not as if there are a million people who think, oh, I've been dying to read a story about oxen. Or about orcas or, you know, any of these subjects that, you know, and I did tons of celebrity profiles when I first began my career. And you don't ever go into a profile of Tom Hanks doubting yourself. You just think, well, people are interested in Tom Hanks. All I have to do is do a good job. I don't have to sell the story to the readers. How do I know that it's going to work? For me, it's purely a gut feeling that my interest is deep enough and infectious enough that I will be able to convey that to readers. So really there's no kind of focus group where I think, well, you know, to go back to the Oxen story, you know, a lot of people are interested in Cuba and lots of people are interested in animals. I mean, I don't plot it out on a spreadsheet and think, okay, this suggests a pre-existing interest that I can tap into. I just go with my gut where I think, you know what? I think this is genuinely interesting. And my job is to explain to you why I think it's so interesting. It's not the easiest way to be a writer. Believe me, it puts a lot of pressure on me. But I feel like I don't know another way to be.
It sounds like what you're describing, and this resonates with the grocery store story you were talking about before. It sounds like what you're talking about is like learning to have confidence in your own sensibility, in your own curiosity, and to trust that a reader will care about it. Will not just care about the thing, but will be able to use your curiosity as a vector to caring about whatever it is you want them to look at.
Oh, exactly. You know, we've all sat at a dinner party where someone who is a very charismatic person will say, let me tell you about my trip to the DMV to renew my driver's license. And, you know, one part of your brain is going, oh my God, I can't imagine a more boring subject. But the person has a twinkle in their eye and they're saying it's an amazing story. And they have a wonderful way of drawing you into the story and giving you details that you had never noticed before about the DMV or the process. And lo and behold, 20 minutes later, you're still listening and you're engaged and enthralled. I think we all love the experience of engagement. Everybody does. What could be more wonderful? And usually we take our chances on something where it's pretty much a guarantee. And to go back to the example of celebrity profiles, if someone says to you, I'm going to profile the guy at the corner who has an auto repair shop, and you think, oh, well, that sounds boring, versus I'm going to profile Tom Cruise, where you think, oh, Tom Cruise, you know, I kind of like Mission Impossible. I'm sort of curious about him. You know, that skeptical position on the unknown subject is a very natural one. And we all have limited amounts of time and a limited appetite for risk. And so generally we migrate to the thing that's the guarantee. You know, if you read a profile of Tom Cruise, there will be a certain satisfaction quotient. On the other hand, I think if somehow you could convey to that same person that the story about the guy with the auto repair shop is really funny and interesting and weird and surprising, they would love to read it. They'd dive into it. But, you know, the first glance is not very promising. And so you have to do everything you can to ask people to give you just a minute to explain to them why this story that seems like a low cost-benefit ratio is really worth their time. And it has to come from the reader, rather from the writer's kind of burning desire to tell the story. And I think readers respond to that. I think readers like when a writer says, this is amazing. I know it's not a subject you thought you would care about, but seriously, it's a great story and you're going to really enjoy it. And again, to go back to what I said previously, I take great pleasure in people saying to me, boy, I never thought I'd read a book about orchids. I didn't write The Orchid Thief for people who have 100 orchids in their house. I mean, I knew they would read it anyway because they're going to read anything with the word orchid in the title. I was really writing it for everyone else, and that included me, who did not know that people were so obsessed with these plants and who couldn't have imagined the length that people would go to acquire them. I was that person. And when people have said to me, boy, I never thought I'd read a book about orchids, my response always was, I never thought I'd write a book about orchids. I didn't even like orchids. I mean, part of the reason that I was curious was my lack of interest in orchids was so profound that when I heard that someone had stolen orchids out of a protected area, I thought, why would anyone do that? That, I don't get it. I don't even like orchids. And you can buy them at Trader Joe's. I mean, what's the big deal? Why would you steal them? So I went into it as that skeptical reader thinking, you know, maybe I'd rather be reading about Tom Cruise. And then lo and behold, it's like, what? This is the craziest story I've ever heard.
Right. I think that makes so much sense. You going in as the skeptic, thinking like, who could care about this? Or like, what, you know, what is this? This sounds weird and arcane. Is probably really helpful in terms of making you the proxy for the reader who then can also become a little obsessed or fall a little in love in the way that you do. What you've been saying brought us so beautifully to a question that I wanted to ask you about your first lines. I have noticed that this collection on animals is like a masterclass in beautiful first lines and in really unusual and intriguing first lines. Forgive me, I'm gonna read two of them. This one was lifelike. As soon as the 2003 World Taxidermy Championships opened, the heads came rolling in the door. Or from the It Bird, if I had never seen Janet Bonney reenact the mouth to beak resuscitation of her hen number 7, who had been frozen solid in a snowstorm, then was thawed and nursed back to life, being hand fed and massaged as she watched doctor shows on TV, I might never have become a chicken person. I just love these. I love the first line so much. And I'm imagining, based on what you've been talking about, that you put a lot of thought into your leads because you have only sort of a limited window of time in which to get a possibly skeptical reader on board with this thing that they don't think that they care about. And I wanted to ask you how you work on the first line, how you work on your openings.
Well, first of all, thank you. I'm chuckling as I'm hearing you read these because sometimes I think, where did that come from? But I absolutely spend a disproportionate amount of time on my leads because, you know, whenever I pull up the channel guide on my television, and I start flipping through channels and I see exactly how much time I give something before I move on. We do that with reading. There's a limited amount of time that most of us give to a story, particularly a story on a subject that we don't come to with a pre-existing curiosity. That amount of time could be measured in seconds, perhaps. So my feeling is either I get you to stick with me a little bit, or there's no hope. there's no way that I'm going to bring you into the story with me where I get to explain to you why this is genuinely interesting if I can't get you to at least give me that minute. So the leads become very important. And I realized some time ago, and this was another liberating revelation and something of a threshold as well, was I think when you are trained as a journalist, even if you're not a newspaper journalist, you do feel that you are obligated in the first sentence or two to give the who, what, where, when, why of a story. And yet it dawned on me at some point, and this was certainly part of the influence of being at The New Yorker and seeing some of the great writers there and examining their work. It dawned on me that you don't have to do that. You have to write something intriguing, and you have to write something that is connected to the story, but people are not reading the lead to get a synopsis of the story. And a synopsis is often very difficult to pull off. And even if you can write a good synopsis, then your entire story is simply repeating that synopsis, but expanding on it, which doesn't feel very satisfying as a narrative arc. You feel as a reader, you want to earn some of what you learn in the course of the story. It was a real breakthrough for me to think, oh, I don't need to give people a shrunken version of the story. I need to give them some inkling, some tidbit that makes them say, oh, what is this about? Let me read the second sentence. Oh, now maybe I know a little bit more. And now the third sentence. In fact, I'd rather, as a reader, enter a story somewhat obliquely and kind of sideways walk into the subject rather than being hit over the head with a 2x4. This is a story about blank. I think it's much more fun as a reading experience to find yourself growing into the story and discovering the story more as it unfolds. So the lead is fantastically important to me. It's your first best chance to get a reader, and also to establish some sense of tone for the story that kind of gives an opening chord to the musical quality of the story. And if all goes well, you have someone hooked by the time they get through the lead and begin moving into the body of the story. It certainly isn't foolproof, but I rarely read a story where the lead is flabby and boring. And there's just too much to read in the world, too many things to listen to and watch. And you read something and it doesn't catch your curiosity, I don't think you're going to stay with it unless it's, your tax return and you have to read it.
Curiosity keeps coming up in this conversation, which is really, I love the idea that can be such a guide, a guiding light for a whole career such a bright and successful career, that it can be led by being very tuned into your own curiosity and thinking very carefully about how curiosity is captured in other people.
Curiosity, we think of it as so ordinary, but it's really not. It's really rather magical. And we all get somewhat lazy as we settle into our lives about being curious, because the familiar is so soothing and comfortable, and it's just easier to surround yourself with things you know, and learning about things you don't know takes a little more effort, and there's a little more of a risk involved. Maybe you won't like it, We tend to begin shying away from those gambles, I think, as we get older and we feel like, you know, I like what I like. I know what I know. If I go to this restaurant, I'm always going to order this dish. It's just comfortable. It feels good. And I do it too. I absolutely understand it. Reawakening or simply reasserting the quality of curiosity, I believe, is a way to really enrich your life.
What are you curious about right now?
I'm actually writing a memoir. So for the first time in my life, I have to turn my curiosity to myself. And that's a challenge that I'm finding quite intriguing and a lot harder than I imagined. To me, being curious about things outside of me has come so naturally that turning that around and being curious about myself has been a lot harder than I expected. And feeling confident that people might be interested, I'm finding a real challenge. And I'm having to talk myself into it much more than writing about orchids or libraries or animals. I'm regularly saying to myself, why would anyone care about my life? And then my other alter ego is saying, no, you've had an interesting life and people will be interested in reading about it. So I'm actually in the midst of this struggle right now with my own story, which I think maybe is the perfect experience for someone like me to say, all right, convince yourself that you're a good story.
It'll probably feel like a relief to go back to something, some other
orchid. More oxen.
Yeah,
more oxen.
Thresholds is a production of Lit Hub Radio. We're produced by Drew Broussard and Justin Alvarez. Music and editing by Laura Faye Oshwood of Arthur Moon. Our art is by Kirsten Huber. Special thanks to Farrar Strauss and Drew. I'm Jordan Kissner. You can find me on Twitter and Instagram at jordan.kissner. We'll see you next week.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
So, Robert, tell the people, what's a pretendian?
It's just what it sounds like, Angel, a pretend Indian.
Someone who fakes being one of us?
Someone who impersonates a native.
We're talking about real scammers and con artists.
There are pretendians teaching at universities, pretendians running governments, pretendians in Hollywood.
On our new podcast, Pretendians, we'll tell you the incredible story of these jaw-dropping frauds.
Who are they? Why do they do it? And how the heck do they keep getting away with it?
Listen to Pretendians on Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.